Hi, and welcome to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals, and do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. When he received a diagnosis of advanced lung cancer, Larry Whipple knew his chances were not good. After an initial consultation near home left him with few options, he became his best own advocate by asking the right questions and seeking the best experts, which meant finding a second opinion nearly 1,500 miles from his hometown. This week, we're talking with Whipple, who's been cancer-free for 2 years, about how his insistence on the best care led to results he could only dream of, and how other patients with cancer can take an active role in their own care, too.
So first off, thank you again, Larry, for taking the time to speak with us today. Can you start off by just giving us a little bit of background? What led to your diagnosis?
Well, my primary care physician of 20 years retired at the end of 2016, and he had a number of partners in his practice, and I then went to one of his surviving partners for an annual checkup in early January. And she had done a pretty in-depth review of my record and saw that there was some indication in a prior either chest x-ray or some scan that was done years back, as early as 2008, that there was some growth or speck in my lung. And she just thought, as a matter of, you know, of what, over caution, if you will, she wanted to have me looked at by a lung specialist, which happened sometime in early 2017. And by the time I got finished with the lung specialist, they had decided that, you know, they would do a scan, a PET scan, and sometime later, you know, in the year. And as it turned out, you know, the PET scan did reveal some growth in the speck, so-called speck, that they had identified years earlier. And both doctors, the anticipated surgeon who was called in to perhaps consider a biopsy, and the lung doctor, concluded that there was no way that this could be cancerous simply because of the, you know, the minimal amount of growth that had been discovered in the early, in the mid-2017 PET scan. So after the PET scan results came out, they decided to do a biopsy of my lung. And I agreed to it. And on September 1, I reported to the hospital for my, you know, biopsy. And that morning, I had a lump that developed in my lymph node on the lower left side of my neck. The doctor explained to me what he was going to do and indicated how the lymph node is somewhat of a roadmap in terms of the existence of cancer in other parts of the body. Well, 2 weeks later, I got a call. The doctor wanted to see me. I went in to see the doctor. This was on September 13, and told me that I had stage 3B lung cancer. And I was with my wife when we received that news. I mean, the image of death, the image of long-term suffering, the image of putting my family through misery ran across my mind because I had my brother-in-law who had died in October of 2016 of pancreatic cancer. And his pancreatic cancer was diagnosed in May, and he was dead in October. So that was my recent experience with cancer. And it turned out that one of our very close friends, same month of diagnosis with pancreatic cancer, died the same month of pancreatic cancer. One in Florida, one in New Jersey. So I wasn't panic stricken, but the first thing we did was to call our daughter, who's a nurse who lives in North Carolina, and then called our son, who lives and works in northern New Jersey, not 20 minutes from the hospital where I was at. So we met for lunch, and by the time my son arrived, and he's a very resourceful and thankfully a very successful father, husband, and business guy, he has on the phone a head of oncology research at Tel Aviv University Hospital in Israel, who talks to me about what kinds of testing and whatever else is there. But over lunch, my son recalled that one of his, and as I said, with the backdrop of pancreatic cancer, one of his close friends had used this Dr. Frank Fasella at MD Anderson in Houston. And I'm kind of leading into, you know, perhaps maybe I'm jumping the gun, you know, after my diagnosis. But my son had mentioned that Mark Ehrenstein, who I knew, my wife knew, they were neighbors and friends, Mark, who was a young man in his mid-40s, had been an 8-year survivor of pancreatic cancer and treated by Dr. Fisella at MD Anderson, literally within 48 hours. And I decided at the time that I was notified that I had this disease, I instantly decided to have a second opinion. I'm a lawyer. I've seen a lot of suffering over the years, and second opinions are always worthwhile because I believe two heads are better than one on any problem or any issue. So the next thing you know, I have an appointment with Dr. Fisella in Houston within a week, although my doctor in New Jersey had said he would submit me for a brain scan, an MRI of the brain, about a month later, and that my wife and I should just simply relax over the next 30 days and go on vacation. I said, yeah, me who can worry over spilled milk, I'm going to be on vacation with the 3B cancer diagnosis hanging over my head. So I went to Houston, flew to Houston, made the appointments, and that's really kind of the conclusion of the first phase of what I experienced having learned.
Yeah. So now you kind of touched on this a little bit on each of the next couple questions, but to kind of just backtrack a little, you had no symptoms up to that point. What was it like hearing the words, you have cancer?
It was like a death knell to me. I mean, I just got goosebumps all over again as you just asked me that question. It was just incomprehensible, especially since I went into the biopsy with the respected opinions of two of my doctors that there's 99% chance that this is not malignant. Right. So and my lawyer, my lawyer instincts, my brain runs across 30 different categories, from protection of my wife, my kids, the disposition of my businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So. Yeah, and really not too much concerned about death. I mean, I'm a little bit cavalier about death and always have been. So, the thought of it becomes kind of incomprehensible because most of the times that we deal with things as human beings, the way to kind of resolve problems is to forget about them or not address them or not deal with them. But this was a reality that I had to confront, and I had to confront it really by myself, although with the support of, my family and my medical advisors.
Yeah. So then what drove you to seek a second opinion so far away, nearly 1,500 miles away from home?
Well, it was the fact that Dr. Fisella, who is one of the leading oncologists at MD Anderson in Houston, and I learned, that MD Anderson was, perhaps second only to Sloan Kettering or Farber. I did some research. I wanted to find out where the best places were and which, entities were utilizing the most advanced, systems. And ironically, Sloan Kettering had a facility right in my hometown in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. It was the first, kind of regional facility that Sloan Kettering had set up. But hearing Dr. Fisella's reputation in terms of what he did with Mark and the fact that he was an 8-year survivor of pancreatic cancer, I said, this is the guy that I want to see if I can see him. I don't know if the guy, charges like $1 million for a consultation. I had no clue. But, I did speak with the man himself who was the survivor, but I did speak with his wife, who was a very aggressive patient advocate for her husband. Well, literally within 6 hours, she had my hotel, she had the plane arranged, she had gotten the appointment for Dr. Fisella to consult with me. And, it was nothing more than a $300 plane ride down to Houston with my wife and a couple of days at a hotel. And since we hadn't had any summer vacation, I said, okay, so we're going on a vacation because of a diagnosis that I didn't expect. And that's why I went to Houston. And a lot of people said, why don't you just go to Sloan? I said, I would, but I have some other information that I find to be potentially very successful and very helpful.
That's great. So once you got to that second opinion appointment, kind of, how did that, the next steps happen after that? What happened at that appointment?
Well, we checked into a hotel, which is physically attached to the main facility at MD Anderson, which is in what they call the Medical Center of Houston. I understood medical center to mean a building. Medical center is I don't know how many hundred square miles of Houston dedicated just to healthcare. Every imaginable facility, an imaginable health facility is in the medical center at Houston. We checked into the hotel, and following check-in, I was directed to a room adjacent to the lobby, or where the check-in counter was, where they took my blood pressure, all in advance of my meeting the next morning at 10 o'clock with Dr. Fisella. Wow. And I had never seen anything like that in my life. And it turned out that, the first of all, there's 100,000 employees of MD Anderson. It exists in six corporate, you know, giant skyscraper structures in, you know, in Houston. And they have over 76 cancer specialist departments in that facility, none of which I knew at the time I had made this appointment to see Dr. Fisella. I was just pleased that he was going to see me. Well, I have to tell you, Jess, I had never in my life experienced any type of the kind of care and the kind of issues. I mean, they even have their own travel agency that will bring you down there just in case you have to change your flight schedule because of chemo, you know, reactions or radiation reactions with no penalty. So, I mean, it was absolutely amazing to me. Although the people up in New Jersey had told me that I was going to have a brain scan because it was explained to me that the first step beyond lung cancer is brain cancer. It spreads quickly to the brain. Well, that night at 11 o'clock, I had a brain scan done at MD Anderson. They had done all the blood workup. They had done all the DNA testing, et cetera, that they use. And by the next morning, the doctor had laid out a treatment plan, confirmed the diagnosis, confirmed the survival rates, et cetera, that we talked about, and confirmed that, you know, in addition to the chemotherapy, which he was recommending that I participate in the immunotherapy, in which in turn was the drug Keytruda. He did give me some encouragement to tell me that 80% of lung cancer patients have this kind of lung cancer, and that this kind of lung cancer has been the subject of some very successful treatment plans. And he says, there's no guarantee. He was very candid with me. And he said, we'll go through a battery of tests and then we'll just take it from there. So the next day after my brain scan had come back, he had set up another appointment. And this was like Friday at 4 o'clock, and told me that this is what his recommendation would be. I asked him if I had to do it all in Houston. He said I did not, that I could go back to New Jersey if I wanted to. And I was very, very comfortable in dealing with this doctor. And I said, well, I do have, you know, some, you know, means to be able to come down here. How frequently will I need it? He said every 3 weeks. And he said, we can start the chemo tomorrow, Saturday morning, which, by the way, was Yom Kippur. I said, I'm not going into a hospital on Yom Kippur. I said, if anything goes wrong with this new therapy you're going to be subjecting me to, I want to be able to find a doctor. So my wife and I spent the weekend in Houston, grateful that we had seen a guy that we both really felt knew what he was doing. And we decided, let's start Monday. And Monday, October 1st, I had my first of several chemo-immuno treatments.
You talked about how there was going to be multiple treatments over the course of, you know, several weeks or months or whatever. What was it like traveling back and forth?
Well, first of all, I found out that wearing a mask gets you through airports very quickly and without lines, you know, a practice that I had followed for several months, not knowing that I was being prepared for the rest of my life. But yeah, it wasn't bad because, you know, the chemotherapy has a severe reduction in your immune system. I literally was quarantined once the chemo started for about 6 months, and took it very seriously. I mean, I didn't go out of the home. My wife and I didn't do any socializing. We saw my son and daughter-in-law once in a while. They have four children, so I didn't really want to be exposed in any way. So the isolation was very difficult. The actual treatment was a cakewalk. I had absolutely zero effect. You can see my coiffure here. That's by choice, and genetics has nothing to do with chemo. And I've learned in life, you know, that happiness and contentment is all related to what your expectations are. So if you manage your expectations and you can manage them effectively, I mean, you can be a pretty happy and pretty content person because you're not disappointed. You know, disappointment causes anger and frustration. But the only disappointment I had in one of the treatments, and it goes to show how you have to be very active as a patient, your own self-advocacy. I'm always concerned about how long I'm going to be in this position because I can't sit still. And they told me that this is my second treatment and that my second treatment would be the same as the first. So when the gal comes in to hook me up to all of these needles and bags and stuff, I said to her, how long is this going to take? And she looks at what's her assignment, et cetera. And she says, oh, you'll be done in an hour. I said, oh, no. I said, there's something wrong here. My doctor told me it's the same treatment. Why 6 hours last time and 1 hour this time? You know, she said, well, let me just go check and verify with my supervisor. Well, lo and behold, there had been a miscommunication between the major pharmacy that orders the drugs and that particular infusion site. I was told that they're going to continue. The doctor had told me they'd done the analysis because I had all these tests done again before each of the therapies. So I had my PET scan. I had the other scans. I don't think I had the brain scan, but I had the others. And they found that in just 3 weeks with this treatment, the tumors that have been discovered had been reduced to about 90% of what their original size was. So they would determine that whatever's happening within my body with these medicines, it was working. And then the same thing happened in the next session, and that too was in Houston, and that was right after Christmas. And arriving after Christmas, I was told that the tumors were reduced to about 40% of the size of all of them, and they were spread out across both lungs, that they had been reduced based upon the comparison of scan to scan.
That's great.
And then the next two treatments I had in New Jersey, because in the interim, MD Anderson had merged with a group of doctors that I had known and worked with over the years. Mm-hmm. So I had my ensuing therapies in New Jersey, but went back to Houston on a couple of occasions, you know, once the chemo and immunotherapies were coming to an end.
That's great.
And that was great. But with each in February of 2018, literally 6 months after my diagnosis. Again, it was like another Christmas morning experience. My wife and I sat with the doctor down in Houston and said that there was no sign of cancer.
Oh,
no sign of cancer anywhere. So, I mean, I just got goosebumps again, just saying that, just recollecting how significant, you know, a message like that was and what an impact it had on our lives.
Yeah, got them too.
Yeah, so, and then they put me in touch with their radio oncologist down in Houston. And this is a Dr. Jeter, had told me that radiation was recommended. I said, but I'm cancer free. Why the hell do I need radiation? And she said, well, and this, my New Jersey oncologist later confirmed it, that the recurrence of lung cancer is commonplace. Sometimes it never comes back. Sometimes it comes back. I had one good friend. She was cancer-free for 8 years, and her cancer recurred at the same time that I received my diagnosis. So then the discussions focused on the radiation, the effects of radiation, where it would be, how long it would take, what the consequences were, et cetera. And between my wife and my wife is a great scrivener. I mean, she keeps tremendous records on everything, my credit card bills. It's usually the other way where I'm watching hers. But I had, you know, I knew enough to ask a lot of the right questions and challenge some of the, not the decisions, but fully understanding why they were doing something and what they were intending to accomplish by virtue of a particular step that they were going to take in my treatment. So, but that was that, you know, so it was after after the fourth treatment is when I learned that I was cancer free.
So then did you had the radiation therapy?
I did. And I went through it for 6 weeks, 5 days a week. Each treatment was about 20 minutes. Again, my challenge was laying still so that the radiation got to the tumors and not to my brain or whatever. That was very difficult because it really interfered with my digestive practice, my swallowing, et cetera. And throughout, at least for a couple of sessions during the radiation, I continued to receive my Keytruda and one of the other chemo drugs. And I think I had that twice during radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it all, by August of 2018, literally 1 year later, cancer-free, radiation completed, recovery from radiation done. And since that time, it's now 2 years almost to the day, you know, where I have been cancer-free. I believe that it was very much a miracle drug phenomenal doctors and a lot of prayer that kind of carried me through this. And having been, I've had some major illnesses, but I'm healthy as a horse. I had, you know, a major heart surgery 25 years ago that was supposed to last 10 years. You know, and I'm trying to figure out, why did I survive this cancer bout? I'm like a cat with nine lives. Right. And perhaps what we're doing here, you know, may be the reason, you know, why I survived what I survived and why I survived it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, because a lot of what you've talked about and a lot of the choices that were made were a result of you and those around you, basically, you know, being your best advocate and sticking up for yourself and asking those important questions. Why is it important to advocate for yourself as a patient?
Well, in my legal work, although I never did any medical malpractice work, I have a number of colleagues and, you know, I stay on top of a lot of areas of the practice of law, that people can make mistakes, honest and genuine mistakes. And it happens in the medical profession. It happens in the legal profession. It happens all over our daily behavior. So just for that reason and that reason alone, I always want to kind of double check and question what's being done. First of all, so I'm aware that I'm hearing what's being said, because so often, you know, you hear something that's not said, or you're interpreting something that's not correct. So by questioning each and every step, the who, what, why, where, and when of every little step they're going to take is just common sense, solid practice in life. But in this particular case, where it could involve death, to me, it was pretty important. And like people said to me, well, why are you going to Houston? I said, because I've concluded in my own mind, whether I'm right or wrong, that this is the best place for me to go to get the treatment that I need. And I'm not looking to live, you know, hooked up to tubes for the next 6 months. I mean, my wife and kids have explicit instructions. Pull those plugs. But I say to my son, make sure I'm not napping, because your mother might get some, she might decide it's in my best interest to pull that plug and I might just be, you know, nodding off her. So, you know, we were able also throughout the process, because we have a very close family and we have a great sense of humor, that helps a lot, you know, yes. When you can step back and laugh at yourself and do whatever.
Definitely.
So, but that's the primary reason why the self-advocacy is important. It's, you know, the old Ronald Reagan comment, you know, trust but verify. Mm-hmm. That's why you trust the recommendation, but just verify that, you know, what the information is or what they're going to do. Yeah. I've never took a second opinion, only because once my treatment moved back to New Jersey, the people in Houston were in constant communication with my doctors and radiologists in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of collaboration and I just trusted, I did, you know, but I verified. And that I think is critical. Exactly. And I would urge that to any patient or family, trust, but verify, it's important.
Exactly. Now that kind of leads into the final question. Basically, we like to kind of wrap up things with asking, you know, your advice. So what advice would you have for other patients who may be recently diagnosed and just don't know where to begin when it comes to being their own best advocate?
Well, the hardest part is that if you let other people know about your diagnosis, everybody has got a recommendation. And to sift through those recommendations, I must tell you, I mean, I had I have a fairly extensive social and business network that I've thrived in over the past 60 years. I must have had 30 different people recommending, from a treatment center in Arizona to this, that. I mean, just amazing the number of people that are willing to help and say, hey, this is what I experienced, this is what you should do. Okay. But I also believe, you know, that you try to find the best people who do what they do that will benefit you. And I determined, based upon a lot of research and a lot of things that I had read, recommendations of doctors, you know, that these were the facilities that were, to, you know, top flight. And so the trying to find, first of all, make certain you get a second opinion and do not delay. And then if you've just been diagnosed, well, then you're halfway there. Now it's a question of making sure that the therapies that you are being subjected to, or, you know, are best for you. And there's a ton of research. There's a ton of support groups. You know, if you don't have a laptop, get access to a laptop so you can go online and study study the things that are written by organizations such as yours or other, you know, support groups or other organizations, even the American Cancer Society. You know, and that then at least gives you some sort of a knowledge base from which you can then operate and go forward. Hmm. And do not give up. You know, one of my daughter-in-law's closest friends, when she heard that I was diagnosed with cancer, she said, "Oh, I feel so sorry for cancer." because I'm a fighter and I don't give up, you know. And I don't know if you can train somebody to do that or what it entails. Never a day felt sorry for myself. Never a day, a minute, or an hour did I feel sorry for myself. I felt sorry for my wife, who was an unbelievable caregiver during this whole process. But my mother advised her 51 years ago before our marriage, she's always stay half packed when you're married to him, because you never know where you got to go and when you got to go. And so she's been that way, and that's the way we've lived our lives. So Houston was nothing. It was just another travel adventure that I looked forward to. I was looking forward to it. I was looking forward to meeting this miracle worker. And it turned out, in my view, he was.
Excellent.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com or find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.